From NPR News in Washington, I'm Anne Bozell. Secretary of State Colin Powell says intense negotiations are going on with China to secure the release of 24 American flyers. China has detained them since they made an emergency landing in southern China last Sunday after their plane collided with a Chinese fighter jet. The Chinese are demanding a U.S. apology, but Secretary of State Colin Powell says they won't get it.
We have expressed regrets and we've expressed our sorrow, and we are sorry that a life was lost. The only life lost to this point was that of the Chinese pilot, and so I think it's a very proper thing to express our regrets and sorrow over that. The question of apology is something quite different, because then we're being asked to accept responsibility, and that we have not done, can't do, and therefore won't apologize for that.
Powell appeared on Fox News Sunday. China is also demanding an end to U.S. surveillance flights off its coast, but Vice President Dick Cheney told Meet the Press those are important to U.S. national security. Meanwhile, American diplomats are waiting for word on whether they'll be allowed to meet with the detained Americans today. NPR's Rob Gifford reports they were able to do so yesterday.
U.S. Defense Attaché Neil Seelock met with the crew for a third time last night, saying he passed on emails from their friends and family and was also able to update them on sports scores in the United States. Seelock said that the crew continued to be in good spirits and that he was pushing for more access to the 21 men and 3 women. There's been no sign yet as to when the crew members will be released. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Beijing.
In Russia, supporters of the embattled independent television station NTV held another rally today, this time in St. Petersburg. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has the latest.
Thousands of NTV supporters rallied in St. Petersburg, warning Gazprom's takeover of the network is a step back from free speech. They held protesters that read, "We won't give NTV to Putin." NTV fans believe President Vladimir Putin is leading a crackdown on independent media. NTV has been a critical voice, but last Tuesday, the state-dominated gas monopoly Gazprom replaced NTV's board of directors. Gazprom insists it was only trying to protect its investment. The ousted managing director of NTV, Yevgeny Kisilyov, and his staff are refusing to recognize the new management. There are some signs Kisilyov's protest is weakening, though. Popular news anchor Tatyana Mitkova has resigned from NTV. Another influential staffer, Leonid Parfionov, complained about the way Kisilyov was handling the protest. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
All flights at the Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam have been delayed. That after an explosion and large fire in the passenger terminal of one of Europe's busiest airports. There are no early reports of any casualties, but thousands of people have been evacuated from the terminal. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld says the search for MIAs will go on in Vietnam despite yesterday's helicopter crash. 7 Americans and 9 Vietnamese were killed when their helicopter slammed into the side of a mountain in southern Vietnam. The bodies of the Americans have been taken to Hanoi and will be flown to Hawaii. In the West Bank, Palestinians have shot dead a man accused of collaborating with Israel. From Jerusalem, NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Witnesses say 3 masked gunmen walked into the shop of Mamoun Frage in Tulkarm and riddled his body with bullets. A group believed linked to Yasser Arafat's Fatah party then issued a leaflet that warned, "This is a message to all spies that we will punish them." Since violence erupted 6 months ago, Palestinians have tried and executed 2 accused collaborators. Several others are on death row. The crackdown is reminiscent of a campaign during the first uprising against Israeli occupation a decade ago. Then dozens of informers were gunned down. In Tulkarm Sunday, neighbors said Frage had worked for Israel during that first uprising and been rewarded with Israeli citizenship. They say he then lived in Israel until moving back to the West Bank 3 years ago. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Security is tight in Israel as the country marks the Passover holiday. 2 bombs exploded today in the Gaza Strip, 1 near a Jewish settlement, the other near an Israeli army post. No one was hurt in either blast. Christian pilgrims lined the streets of Jerusalem today. They celebrated Palm Sunday, the first day of Holy Week before Easter. The number of pilgrims was smaller this year because of the violence in the region. I'm Anne Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for people and institutions worldwide, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Like toppling dominoes, the foot and mouth epidemic sweeping across the British countryside has led from slaughtering herds to political posturing to an historic decision to put off the date of the general election by 1 month, the first time that's happened since the Second World War. The action gives British politicians an extra month to reach voters in what is traditionally only a 2-month campaign season. However, they're not allowed to spend any more money. No worries, though their cash is limited, British campaigners have creative ways of using the media, as On the Media's Gareth Mitchell reports from London.
The British public faces a general election campaign lasting nearly 2 months, a long time in UK politics. It's almost certain that the ruling Labour Party, led by Prime Minister Blair, will get in for a second term. These are prime ingredients for a bored electorate. Voter apathy could severely dent Labour's majority. David Hill is one of the UK's leading PR consultants, and as a former director of communications at the Labour Party, was one of the masterminds behind Tony Blair's victory in 1997. David says that, though it's tempting to throw money at the current election campaign, legislation limits the amount parties are allowed to spend.
The limit in this country is now roughly £15 million, which is about $20 million. Everything that the party spends during the course of what is designated as the election period has to come within that $20 million threshold.
Lord Raynard, campaign director for the UK's third biggest party, the Liberal Democrats, maintains that despite the cap on spending, the parties have plenty of scope for selling their policies to the electorate.
I think there's every opportunity in Great Britain for parties to get their message across. And they do it here more perhaps through volunteers, calling and visiting people personally, delivering party leaflets, direct mail methods of that sort. You have less danger that a party can simply buy the election, but it has so much more money.
But as well as spending limits, campaigners face another significant restriction. They can't buy time to advertise on the TV and radio networks here, but they do get some airtime for free. Gary Ward is head of communications at the Advertising Standards Authority.
Parliament has decided that over the years, broadcast media is such a crucial element that it's important that everyone has a pretty fair access to that and isn't able to buy advantage. And so the main political parties are all entitled to a certain amount of time to have a 5-minute spot, which they call a party political broadcast.
Liberal Democrats have shown what can be done in government, in Scotland, now in Wales too. Why not the whole country?
If you'd like to know more about the Liberal Democrats or to join the party, write to Charles Kennedy.
A recent party political London broadcast from the website of the aforementioned Liberal Democrat Party, given by leader Charles Kennedy. The UK's TV networks don't charge for the airtime. However, according to PR consultant David Hill, in exchange for the free airtime, broadcasters may exert some oversight over how the candidates use their space.
Those broadcasts have then to be vetted by the channels to see if they are acceptable. They usually are. It's only a rare occasion when they say that there is something too unpleasant or too abusive or inaccurate about those broadcasts. But it is the case that there is the ultimate power of the broadcasters to say they feel that a broadcast should either be altered in some way or withdrawn.
But away from broadcast, candidates can find the closest thing to free speech on the humble billboard.
There's more freedom of expression in billboard advertising than there is in party broadcasting for the two reasons. That one, there are no rules applying to what's on the billboards, where there are some rules that apply to what goes in your party broadcast. And secondly, you can put your billboards anywhere you want and as many of them as you want, as long as you stick by the spending rules, whereas the authorities actually have a statutory limit on the number of broadcasts that can take place during a campaign.
When David Hill was at the centre of the Labour Party's successful 1997 general election campaign, he learned that the best way of getting around the restrictions is for parties to get their PR right.
If you have got a restriction on the amount you can spend, if you do know there are certain rules that you can't break, then you have to say to yourself, how do we exploit what is available to us every minute, every hour and every day? And that is about having the right people talking to the press and the right people knowing how to deliver the stuff that will maximise good coverage in newspapers and on television and radio.
In Britain, lacking the jackhammer of ads on the TV and radio, successful campaigning is partly about flirting with the media and, of course, donning a good pair of walking shoes and meeting the voters in their neighbourhoods. One handshake, one vote might not be that time efficient, but combined with a nice cup of tea and discussion about the weather, it's very British. For On the Media, this is Gareth Mitchell in London.
Many on the right of the political spectrum believe that Dan Rather of the CBS Evening News slants coverage to a liberal point of view. There's even a website called ratherbiased.com curated by two college students, Greg and Matthew Sheffield. Here's Greg Sheffield with what he regards as the most egregious example of Rather bias.
New President Bill Clinton congratulated Dan Rather on his on-air partnership with Connie Chung. Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. If we could be 1/100th as great as you and Hillary Rodham Clinton have been together in the White House, we'd take it right now and walk away winners. Dan Rather at a meeting for CBS affiliates, speaking to Bill Clinton via satellite, May 27, 1993.
Until last week, this was all an academic argument. The right complained that Rather slanted, and Rather replied, quote, bull feathers. But then the Washington Post exposed what his critics believe is the smoking gun, an appearance he made March 21st at an Austin, Texas Democratic Party fundraiser. Though he denies knowing the event was a fundraiser, Rather has apologized for speaking at a partisan event and for adding to the perception that, as a journalist, he doesn't play it straight down the line.
Joining us now is Bob Steele, who directs the Journalism Ethics Program at the Poynter Institute. Bob, Dan Rather is the poster child for media bias. If this were Ted Koppel or Tom Brokaw who had done this fundraiser, maybe less of an uproar?
Frankly, I think that any major journalist who had found himself or herself in the same situation would be challenged by those to the political right, and it's a reasonable challenge to raise. I don't think it proves that Dan Rather is a liberal sympathizer. What this situation proves to me is that Dan Rather used exceptionally bad judgment in going to this political event, which was also a political fundraiser.
Of course, from a journalism ethics point of view, maybe it doesn't matter if he is a liberal sympathizer, and you know, maybe it doesn't matter if he's a crypto communist, so long as in doing his job, he is an honest broker of the news and does nothing to slant his coverage in line with whatever his political sympathies are. Does he have an equal responsibility, not from a journalism ethics point of view, not to make public appearances that might leave the perception of a bias, even if there is none?
Yes. Dan Rather and all other journalists in this country have an obligation to guard their credibility and that of their news organization. They should not do anything which raises the perception of an ideological bias. This situation is complicated to some degree by the fact that Dan Rather's daughter is active in Democratic politics in Texas, as I understand it, and was part of the fundraising evening. Dan Rather is not the first journalist to be in a difficult situation where an immediate family member is involved in politics. But in those situations, the journalist must accept that he or she has to honor journalistic principles.
And actually, the fact that his daughter is intimately a part of the Democratic politics in that county makes it seem all the more disingenuous, maybe, that he claimed ignorance that it was a fundraising event to begin with.
Well, it's beyond me how he could have gone to this political event without asking questions about the nature of the event and without asking questions about what was transpiring and whether it was a fundraiser. Frankly, I think he was ill-advised to attend it, period, whether it was a fundraiser or not.
Because irrespective of whether this actually is a smoking gun, there are a lot of people out there who will treat it that way.
Well, that's certainly the case. I mean, I hear these kinds of concerns and complaints on airplanes when my seatmates ask what I do, and I say, I do journalism ethics, and after a good chortle, they usually raise a litany of challenges to why the media is unfair and biased. It's nothing new to me, and while it's frustrating, I understand the public's at times disenchantment or anger to the press. And when a journalist, particularly one of the profile of Dan Rather, goes into a minefield and sets off an explosion, as he did in this situation, we are undermining our ability to serve the public to the degree that we should and must.
Should he be punished for this?
Well, it seems to me that this is a pretty significant trip for Dan Rather to do what he did. And I don't mean in the literal sense of a trip to Texas, but a trip wire, if you will, and setting off at least a small explosion in a case like this. Should he be disciplined? I would need to know what the CBS standards are in this case. I would also want to know whether Dan Rather had talked to anybody at CBS before he did this and whether they gave him clearance on it.
All right. Bob Steele, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Bob Steele is the director of the ethics program at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida.
And now, corrections. On March 11th, the New York Times Five From column about Wolfgang Puck's five favorite dishes prepared by other chefs referred incorrectly to the chicken at L'Ami Louis in Paris. It is simply roasted. It is not prepared in the Basque style.
In the April 1st San Francisco Chronicle, the Sporting Green column erroneously said Zsa Zsa Gabor is dead. Also, a quote about America's unfamiliarity with China was wrongly attributed to basketball player Yao Ming. The speaker was fellow player Wang Zhiji.
I aired in the March 23rd edition of On the Media when I stated that Roman Emperor Commodus was killed by his wife. His wife only attempted to kill him. He was strangled in bed by his wrestling partner.
In the March 29 Des Moines Register, an article about the repercussions of topless oil wrestling at a Clive bar gave the wrong title for I. John Rossi. He is an administrative law judge.
And on page 2 of the Metro section of the March 30th St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Vicki Tritton-Meyer's name was misspelled in a story about heart transplant patient Linda Horner, who was being transported to the hospital in a helicopter when it was hit by a duck, subsequently named Chopper by Horner. Chopper did not survive the ordeal, and Myers is Chopper's taxidermist.
Coming up, another media merger, the decline of the labor beat, and public relations for Freemasons.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The merger of the week wasn't a mega merger on the order of AOL Time Warner, but a meta merger, because the business of both companies involved is reporting on media.
Inside.com was known for thorough business reporting on every aspect of the media, using in-depth graphics, a team of veteran reporters, and a big PR budget in New York and L.A. But it also used up $20 million in funding, and like most other internet sites which peddled content, Inside found it couldn't sell subscriptions fast enough to stay afloat.
Along comes Stephen Brill, who folds Inside.com's parent company into his own. Joining me now is Kurt Anderson, one of Inside's founders and a vice chairman of the newly formed Inside Content. Kurt, I don't know whether to congratulate you or not. Are congratulations in order?
Congratulations are very definitely in order.
Tell me why.
Well, as one of my friends and employees said, it's victory with an asterisk. The thing we've the amazing thing we've created, Inside.com and Inside Magazine, can go on to live many and many another day. And I can relax a little while and take fully seriously my new entirely amorphous role of vice chairman.
Things haven't worked out exactly as you'd anticipated, however.
I had no specific anticipation. I stumbled into what looked like a lot of fun and interesting and something I hadn't done. And for about the first 5 minutes, it looked like, you know, there might be some money, serious money in it.
The ease with which you got venture capital must have turned your head a little bit. You're one of your famous quotes
was that
funding was, oh, allow me to share it with our listeners, will you? Getting funding for Inside was easier than getting laid in 1969.
Now, let me use this opportunity to finally, once and for all, put that quote, which I gave to Howard Kurtz of the Washington Post, into context. Howard asked me, what is so special about Inside and this team you've collected and this idea you have? What is so special that you've been able to raise all this money? And I said, no, it's not us. There's a lot of money around. Raising money now is as easy as blah, blah, blah. And may I also say that it was a mistake. I should have said 79 because that's, frankly, when it was easy, at least for me, to get laid.
All right, next subject.
Yes.
Your new partner, Stephen Brill, has, I guess there's two main aspects to his reputation. And one is, shall we say, for not being a shrinking violet, but also for being a scold. Your Inside.com online now calls Brill's content the church lady, journalism's church lady.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel dancing with the church lady?
Well, I think that the thing we intend to do will have next to no church lady aspects. And I'll tell you, one of the things I like about Steve in the short time I've gotten to know him is that when I say exactly that and worse in my description of why Brill's content has never been a must-read for me or my favorite magazine, he absolutely cops to it. So whether it's film or television or books or journalism or whatever, they all have interesting stories, that they all have interesting business stories, and that a kind of scolding, prosecutorial approach is, you know, when deserved, one approach to take, but there are many, many, many other voices in the choir that can be allowed to sing. And so that is a vision of what we hope to create together.
In merging with Brill Media Holdings, you're also merging with his partners, which includes CBS, NBC, and Prime Media. Having business ties with some of the companies you'll be reporting on, does that cause you any worries?
No, none, frankly. Steve has shown himself in his track record sort of above reproach in terms of being willing to anger advertisers, partners of all kinds. I also, you know, having run a magazine, a couple of magazines, and being around these worlds for a while, seems to me that it's absolutely clear to me, in fact, that the real pressure to change stories, pull stories, whatever, are from advertisers, far, far more than any kind of corporate entanglement.
Finally, this is a very complicated deal, or at least it seems to be based on the stories I've read.
It's even more complicated than you can imagine.
But fundamentally, yes. The unprofitable Inside.com is merging with the unprofitable Brill's content to form Inside Content Magazine and the associated websites. In the current media advertising depression, does this combined entity have any chance of making it?
It really does. And first of all, you're leaving out the third and in many ways as a financial story, the most important part of this story, which is the Prime Media involvement. The part of Prime Media that is being thrown into this mix, in this enterprise, is a company that called Media Central, which is a subsidiary of Prime Media. That is a very profitable business today. So the story is persuasive to me that this can work, and I believe it, and I'm happy not to be the person who is any longer charged with executing the plan.
All right, Kurt, thanks very much for joining us.
It has been my pleasure.
Kurt Anderson is the vice chairman of the new Inside Content. He's also the host of Studio 360, a co-production of Public Radio International and WNYC. And in the spirit of full disclosure, WNYC also produces On the Media.
The U.S. Labor Department released its unemployment figures this week. The ranks of the jobless swelled 18,000 to 383,000. That's the highest level in 3 years. The heaviest losses were in machinery, metals, and manufacturing, industries with the kind of workforce that traditionally formed the backbone of America's dwindling unions.
We mention this because the decline of organized labor has been followed, mirrored actually, by the decline of the labor beat. Reporter Susan Wood looked into the changing nature of workplace coverage.
Hi there, early birds. Deadline coming up for Massachusetts, Michigan, Virginia, West Virginia, Illinois, Indiana. Deadline for what? Deadline for becoming a citizen.
In the 1950s, Detroit auto workers could tune in to radio station WDET, a show called Eye Opener, funded by the United Automobile Workers and hosted by one of its staffers, Guy Nunn, served up daily news and commentary with a labor slant. Stanley Aronowitz is professor of sociology and cultural studies at the City University of New York Graduate Center.
At the one point, the United Automobile Workers was not only interested in their own members' wages and working conditions, but they were also interested in being a major influence, which they still are, in the Democratic Party of the state of Michigan. And they thought in order to do that, they had to have their independent presence in the media, so they started a radio station.
Here, Nunn interviews UAW President Walter Reuther, 1 month before the 1956 election.
Walter, Republicans claim that everybody's been sharing in this thing which they call prosperity, and they cite production indices. What do you say to that?
Well, you've got to get behind their political double talk to find out what the facts are. And I say that the facts indicate beyond challenge that the Eisenhower Republican Big Business Administration has created a lopsided, unsound, and uneven prosperity in America.
By the end of the decade, labor's voice had largely faded from the airwaves. Of the hundreds of labor radio shows that flourished at mid-century, only a handful remain today. Likewise, labor is commanding less attention from the mainstream media. Nowhere is this more apparent, critics say, than in the decline of the labor beat. William Sarin, who teaches journalism at New York University, was the New York Times labor reporter from 1979 to 86. His experience there was a far cry from the 40s, when the Times had four full-time labor reporters.
Listen, at the New York Times, I was one labor reporter, and sometimes we had a half of another person. One and a half labor reporters at the most against, what, 60, 70 business reporters. Right now, as we're talking, there are probably 10, 12 labor journalists in this country.
Sarin pioneered a course in labor reporting last spring, and he's teaching it again this year, though he admits it's not his most popular course. He says it's tough to persuade students to enter a field with so few opportunities for advancement.
Labor journalism is simply not considered at most papers and magazines a high-end job, and we shouldn't even talk about radio and television because they don't do much labor reporting at all. And it's crazy because you have, what, a workforce of 130 million in this country, and the work still makes this country what it is.
Part of the problem, says Tom Robbins, a staff writer at the Village Voice, is that in the minds of many journalists, labor is synonymous with organized labor.
Both reporters and editors were perceiving it as, let's write about unions as such, whether or not the unions are doing well, whether or not the unions are in trouble, whether or not people are joining unions, whether or not they're leaving unions. They weren't writing about the phenomenon of work.
Robin says that when his former employer, the New York Daily News, approached him about taking the labor beat, his first impulse was to redefine the assignment.
Work is the, you know, all-encompassing phenomenon that everybody does who needs to be able to feed and clothe themselves. And it covered everybody from, you know, the people at the top of the spectrum on Wall Street to the people who were just cleaning up the floors at the Daily News.
Workplace reporting is the fastest-growing beat at many newspapers around the country. But some papers use it as an excuse not to cover organized labor, according to Janine Jackson, program director for the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
We've seen labor stories replaced with a kind of softer thing called workplace coverage, which treats workers' issues as if they were almost lifestyle or cultural questions rather than economic questions. So we're not hearing about the minimum wage or about outsourcing. We're hearing about dress-down Fridays.
Sometimes I see business sections at other newspapers using workplace reporters mainly to write stories about what's the best way managers can efficiently use their employees in a way that increases their bottom line.
Those are legitimate stories, says Stephen Greenhouse, who covers labor and workplace issues for the New York Times. But it's only one aspect of the beat. Reporters should look at discrimination, health, and safety. labor issues, but not specifically union issues. In fact, until recently, unions rarely addressed those concerns. But that's no longer the case, says Edward Ott, director of public policy for the New York City Central Labor Council.
Trades are more integrated, and they're engaged with the youth of this city in a much different way. Apprentice programs, pre-apprentice programs, trying to get communities that have been traditionally kept out of the trades into the trades. It's a major story. You guys have missed it.
If stories like these aren't being covered, one reason, according to FAIR's Janine Jackson, is corporate ownership of the media, which focuses attention on the bottom line and on the upscale consumers advertisers want to reach.
With all of these mergers that you hear about, they go along with a lot of cost-cutting, and that cost-cutting hits the newsroom very hard. Reporters tell us, I used to have to file 3 stories a week, now I have to file 3 stories a day. What that means is they simply don't have the resources to go more deeply into a story, and they're that much more reliant on corporate public relations.
But Stephen Bell, managing editor of the Buffalo News, says community service, not corporate strategies, decide what gets covered at his paper, even though it's owned by billionaire investor Warren Buffett. But even in Buffalo, where more than a quarter of the workforce is unionized, the news no longer has a full-time labor reporter, a decision Bell defends.
I think it's a little simplistic to look at, does a paper have a labor beat reporter? And if they do, gee, that means they must cover labor. And if they don't, that means they must not. Between 1998 and today, we've written almost 2,200 stories involving labor unions.
Bell says labor coverage is actually enhanced by splitting it up among different beats.
It used to be the union beat meant covering what was happening at the steelworkers' local, and when is the contract up, and will the wage increase be sufficient? So in some cases, I think you could argue that labor coverage today, and I'm not just talking about us, but in general, is more sophisticated and is more infused throughout the newspaper than it used to be.
So when a telemarketing operator looks in her local newspaper for coverage of efforts to unionize her workplace, should she look for it on the metro page, the business page, or the technology page? Until unions figure out how to reclaim the media spotlight, she's probably going to find it on the lifestyle page. For On the Media, this is Susan Wood in New York.
This week on the Freemason Front, in England, a government move to prevent Freemasons from recruiting among members of the armed forces has been blocked because of claims that it violates the European Conventions on Human Rights. However, in Wales, Freemasons this week lost their bid to change the rule forcing members of the government assembly to disclose their membership.
Meanwhile, in Las Vegas, meetings of the Freemasons were listed in the local events calendar right in between the library club and cancer screenings, and a few items down from the Pinochle group. Why such different treatment in different places? The Freemasons believe the answer is public relations, and the membership has hired a PR firm to cleanse Freemasonry of its clandestine taint.
Mike Duwar of MDA Communications has been hired by the Freemasons to manage their press. Mike, the goal of any PR campaign would be to dispel myths and negative perceptions about whoever you're representing, in this case the Masons. One of the chief characteristics of this group has been its secrecy. Why suddenly in the 80s, 90s, and today are they trying to change that?
Well, I think they've had a bad press, certainly in Britain, over the last probably 40, 50 years. It was only perhaps in the 80s that they started thinking about coming out. In Britain, they had one or two rather unsuccessful attempts to come out, and they got a bad press. They still had the secretive image. They had the image of people who did favors to fellow Masons and so on, a degree of corruption, sinister almost. The fact of the matter is that for the last 20 years, certainly, their membership is not secret. The only thing which they keep to themselves, and they prefer to use the word private, is their induction ceremony. And they justify that by saying, this is what makes being a Mason special. Otherwise, it'll become like the Rotary Club or whatever. I mean, what does it matter if they roll up a trouser leg? It may not be your bag or mine.
There was a report on the BBC this month that said new members are blindfolded, wearing a hangman's noose, and are warned that their throats will be slit and their tongues torn out, and they will be buried in the sand if they betray anyone else in the Brotherhood. This is hardly a matter of a trouser rolled.
First of all, those words were discontinued about 20 years ago. They were, of course, only symbolic. I haven't found too many Freemasons with slit throats. When those words did exist, they had come right down from the early 18th century, when those sort of oaths were commonplace.
How do you plan to get the Freemasons into the press and into the press favorably, and why do the Freemasons feel they need this now?
Well, I think they want to be perceived as modern and, more important, as relevant. In summer 2002, we have a Freemasonry in the Community Week, and the idea will be to make an impact right across the country that Freemasons really are part of the community and a useful part of the community. We intend to start up a magazine for them so that they sing off the same hymn sheet, if you like. It'll be internal PR. We've improved their website. We're improving their literature. I could go on.
Freemasonry is open to people of all races, nationalities, and creeds, but not to women. Why not?
Yes. And again, I find that very easy to defend. I do believe our democracy here is grown up enough and adult enough that if boys want to be boys together and if girls want to be girls together, that's absolutely fine, and that's not sexist. So that one, funnily enough, is certainly in Britain, just not a problem.
I have read that the population of the Freemasons is aging alarmingly, and is part of this PR effort an attempt to boost membership?
Well, they don't recruit, but certainly they would be happy if I created an atmosphere in which it might be easier for younger members to be invited. But their membership hasn't tumbled drastically. It's now a third of a million in this country, and I think in its heyday it was about 500,000.
When dealing with the challenges of representing Freemasonry, you have to come up against some pretty, I think you would regard as far-fetched conspiracy theories: Freemasonry associated with UFOs, Freemasonry associated with the Kennedy assassination. Do you have to respond to these sorts of theories, or do you just leave them alone?
If it is a general wild accusation, one tends to be dismissive and just poo-poo it. If it's a specific one and I don't know the answer, I'm quite honest and I say I don't know the answer. But the Freemasonry organization is absolutely the first to admit there have been rotten apples. And so I know that that has been a general answer which I have given.
Do you blame the media for the Masons' bad image?
No, I don't. Not really. The media report perceptions. It's their job to. They have some favorite whipping boys. They always have done. And I think the Masons are one of their favorite whipping boys. But in my experience, if you do a good enough job for long enough in trying to change their mind, usually they come around. So I've obviously got a challenge on my hands.
Thank you very much.
Not at all.
Mike Duar is the managing director of MDA Communications in London, a public relations firm which has been recently hired by the Freemasons.
Oh, the abattoir, that's not important. But if one of you could put in a word for me, I'd love to be a Freemason. Freemasonry opens doors. I mean, I was a bit on edge just now, but if I was a Mason, I'd just sit at the back and not get in anyone's way.
Thank you.
I've got a second-hand apron.
Thank you.
Coming up, political comedy, questionable commercials, and corporate anthems.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Now, our inaugural edition of OTM's exclusive feature, important stuff we couldn't fit anywhere else in the show. Brooke, what do you have this week?
I have a commercial. This is the controversial commercial of Martin Luther King selling communications equipment from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. The way that the commercial has it, it's a commercial for a company called Alcatel Americas.
King is delivering the I Have a Dream speech from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963, but the crowd of hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of spectators has been digitally erased, and King is completely by himself speaking. And then at the end of it, there's a voiceover that says,
"Before you can touch,
that all men are created,
you must first connect."
The reaction to this commercial has been uniformly negative from all over the country. Leonard Pitts in the Chicago Tribune said, "I'd like to connect, all right, my foot with the backside of whoever conceived and approved this piece of historical vandalism." And then we have Barry Saunders in the Raleigh News and Observer saying, "Ironic, isn't it, that the dude survived attempts by FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to destroy his image, yet that image is being sold and sullied in death by his own family." I could read more, but I think these couple of responses are pretty typical of what we've seen.
Well, allow me to stake out a contrarian point of view. Also, let me put on my advertising critic hat for a moment. Look, if you frame the question as what could some multinational fiber optic stringer have to say that possibly measures up to the defining moment of this country's civil rights struggle, the answer is obviously nothing. But, you know, I don't think that's how to frame the question. Alcatel's question essentially is, if the defining moment of the civil rights struggle fell on Washington's Mall, and nobody had been there to witness it, would it have made a noise? And I think that's an interesting inquiry. I think it's a legitimate inquiry. I don't believe this commercial in any way dishonors Dr. King or his message or in any way cheapens it. Now, we live in a society where advertising and everything else about the commercial culture cheapens almost everything that is sacred to us, from President's Day and, you know, you celebrate Memorial Day by going down to the Chrysler dealer for the big sell-a-thon. And, you know, I don't think this commercial in any way approaches the sort of commercial crassness of those. The NAACP has been fairly vocal about this. There's a lot of people concerned with what they think is the King family profiteering on Dr. King's image. But, you know, whether the King family is doing that is, I think, irrelevant to the question here. And that is, does this commercial paint this speech and this moment in history in a flattering way or in somehow in an irreverent way? And for my part, I'm annoyed with the digital animation effect they use because it makes Dr. King at some point look like a character in a video game. But the substance of the thing I found actually quite inspiring, and the question it raises I think is perfectly legitimate.
I really disagree. I don't think it dishonors his message, but I think it certainly diminishes and dilutes it, Bob. I mean, the fact is, there are certain things that are meant to be simply what they are and not stand for anything else. It's true, Christmas has been diminished, and we go out and buy mattresses on Memorial Day weekend. But this country has still lived that moment, was alive during that moment. And because the race struggle still exists, is still very present, I think this moment ought to be preserved in amber as it was for what it was.
Well, I certainly understand. I think for the moment anyway, I'm going to stay out here in Contrarianville. And let's talk now about a second commercial. This one was from the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals promoting spaying of house cats. And it was submitted to a cable network, but rejected on the grounds that it was too pornographic. It was, of course, two house cats, or at least animatronic puppets of house cats, doing the dirty to some sort of percussive and, I think, erotic musical bed.
And the network in question was MTV.
MTV rejected a commercial because it was too erotic. What is that all about?
What that is about, Bob, clearly, is hypocrisy. As one PETA rep said, is carnal knowledge between cat puppets more problematic than seeing one of Cisco's thong song dancers waving her buttocks at the camera?
In all probability, they never really expected to get this commercial aired anyway. This is a kind of rejection marketing wherein you create a spot that you know will be controversial, and you really don't have a lot of money to put on TV, but you create one that you're almost certain will be rejected, and then you take the rejection and get tons of publicity for it, far outstripping anything you might have achieved by actually having some minor media buy. So I think this has worked out famously for just about everybody except possibly MTV.
Well, thanks, Bob, for being on the Media.
No, Brooke, thank you for being on the Media.
You're welcome.
No, you're welcome.
Be good, kitty.
Bumping, This week we return to the classroom of former Vice President Al Gore. His stint as guest professor at the Columbia School of Journalism has drawn big-ticket talkers, Rupert Murdoch and Alan Greenspan among them. This time he hosted a host, David Letterman.
Mr. Gore cited the now familiar statistic that 13% of Americans, 50% of those under 30, get what he called a good bit of their news from late-night comedy shows like Letterman's. But Letterman dismissed the idea that jokes influenced voting. More people read the funny pages than the front page, he said. But do they act on what they see in Blondie on a given day? Do they say, here's what Dagwood did, so I'm going to do it?
As usual, On the Media managed to plant a mole in the classroom. Student Ben Stein joins us now. So, Ben, how did it go?
Went very well. It was very entertaining. Letterman seems to know a lot more than you would think as, you know, the host of a network talk show.
Did he let on how he regards the news media?
Yeah, I think so. He said that you could get more interesting insight from flipping through the yellow pages at a fast pace than you can through watching local news.
How about the national media? Did he weigh in on them?
Well, I guess besides the point in trying to say that he's more interesting than Larry King, he didn't really weigh in too much on the national media.
Let me ask you this, Ben. Professor Gore's class, thus far you have had Alan Greenspan, you've had Rupert Murdoch, now David Letterman. Are you going to a class in journalism or are you going to a celebrity talk show?
I'm getting the sense that sometimes when Gore is up there in a chair next to his guests like Letterman or Greenspan, it is sort of like a talk show, and then, you know, and then Letterman lets us chime in.
How about Professor Gore? Does he let you chime in? Has he really been responsive to the questions you've asked him over the weeks about, let's say, for example, the recount in Florida?
The professor has not answered any questions about the recount in Florida. One was made today by one of my friends in the class, and Gore said, I'm not going to answer it. And that was in relation to an article saying that Bush would have won the election if there had been a recount.
In previous classes, there have been some restrictions, for example, on what you were permitted to ask Alan Greenspan. So you have a class full of budding journalists and an ever-growing list of subject areas that they're not permitted to touch. Is there a sense of frustration in the class, or has everyone just sort of accepted this as the situation that they have to live with?
You know, the consensus is that we're not going to be able to get to Gore. We're not going to be able to ask him about his experience in Washington. And I've accepted this right now as just sort of an experience.
This raises the question, though, if not his experience in Washington, what does qualify Al Gore to lecture to students to begin with? You might as well have Sally Jesse Raphael as your professor.
Al Gore has told us that he's an experienced reporter. He reported before he went into politics, and he just has so much experience in dealing with the national media and local news media that he wants to bring his perspectives from this experience into our classroom.
With 3 weeks to go, who's benefiting the most? Is Gore getting more out of Columbia, or is Columbia getting more out of Gore?
I don't think Gore is benefiting. I think Columbia Journalism School is certainly benefiting from it. It's definitely giving it a lot of exposure. As far as the students, we could benefit from this if we had the right access to Gore, and we could ask him more questions about his experience as vice president, and especially the recount saga in Florida.
All right. Ben Stein, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Ben Stein is a student in Professor Al Gore's class in journalism at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism.
Recently, in Britain's Guardian newspaper, there was an article about corporate anthems as the next big thing. The reporter singled out one ditty for special scorn for a company called KPMG. The reporter said, "The tune of sorts extolling the virtues of chartered accountants is just one among many, the tip of a terrible oncoming iceberg. Welcome to musical hell," this rather fractious writer went on, "a place where men and women trill glutinous couplets about teamwork and customer care and vainglorious paeans to company spirit."
Corporate anthems are not geared to customers, but to company staff. And though they may have just arrived in Britain, they have long been a staple of Japanese management. Of course, here in America, we have inevitably taken the form right over the top, as On the Media's Rex Doan reports.
Early corporate anthems, like this one for IBM, sounded more like fight songs for someone's dear old alma mater than anything else. But by the 1950s, mere song and verse gave way to big, brassy industrial shows with multiple musical numbers dedicated to pushing product.
Standing on the corner, watching all the Fords go by. Standing on the corner, giving all the Fords the eye.
Steve Young is a writer for The Late Show with David Letterman and is the foremost collector and researcher of industrial show souvenir albums.
They were very lavishly produced Broadway-style reviews, often using legitimate Broadway talent and name-brand composers to put on a whole musical to motivate the sales force and not only just inspire them to sell, but also inspire them to feel good about the way of life they've chosen.
Coca-Cola, drawn from the experience of the past and the opportunities of the here and now.
Some of the big corporations like GM and Coca-Cola have a lot of very bombastic material that goes beyond just details about the product that may be at hand, but giving you a much more overarching view of this, where the reason that life is worth living, that sort of thing. You see a lot of that in Coca-Cola shows.
Coca-Cola here and now, wherever you may be.
This one is a real over-the-top, bombastic song that's sort of sketching out how Coca-Cola pretty much equals America and freedom and beauty and life worth living. And this is the sort of thing that would bring tears to the eyes of grown-up sales executives sitting in the audience.
In addition to writing songs that appear in such major films as Shane and Sabrina, Wilson Stone penned Coca-Cola's Here and Now, along with several other industrial show tunes for corporations like Chevrolet, Cadillac, and Xerox. Stone was drawn to writing industrial shows for the familiar reasons.
We would have a cast of 30 people and a 60-piece orchestra. You know, they were huge. And we really used all Broadway people because they paid so much money. So we all did it just for the money.
The size and budget that industrial shows used to boast still amazes Hank Beebe, who worked in the field for over 20 years.
Well, the only figures I remember are the ones for the first show, which was in 56 for the 57 line. And that show was budgeted at six times the cost of bringing My Fair Lady to Broadway that same year.
Proud, proud, Chevrolet proud, proud, proud.
How does it feel?
By Beebe's math, that means that the 1957 Chevrolet Extravaganza carried a price tag of over $3 million. A considerable sum to be sure, but perhaps deserved.
It's an easy thing to write a song about love. It's hard to write a song about spark plugs.
How it feels to feel Chevrolet proud, bright broad banners everywhere.
Indeed, the lyrical content of many industrial show songs bordered on the bizarre. Again, Steve Young.
The Bathrooms Are Coming is from 1969 from the American Standard Company, and it's pretty much got everything you could want in an industrial show. It's got a song called My Bathroom, which is a sort of wonderful tribute to a woman's bathroom and how much it means to her.
My bathroom, my bathroom is a private kind of place.
Like some traveling production of Cabaret for Carburetors, many of the industrial shows even toured from city to city for regional sales meetings. But by the mid-1980s, the light would dim on the industrial show. Bloated budgets and the emergence of multimedia presentations silenced the corporate chorus line. So today, the only place the industrial show lives on is in the living room of collector Steve Young, a fact that makes one wonder about the cumulative effects of listening to the over 150 industrial show albums that are in the possession of this sub-subgenre's sole archivist.
I wouldn't say I've been brainwashed by listening to these songs, but I feel like, boy, I really like Massey Ferguson tractors now. I've never been on a tractor in my life, but boy, I'd be proud to own one. I'd be proud to sell and service one.
She's a driving rain and a wind on the plain. She's as hard as a Midwest winter. You hold the key to the land of the free, and you know the power is in her. So stand up proud and say it loud. This is the world of winners. Sing it!
Yes, we're Massey.
Massey's number one.
For On the Media in New York, I'm Rex Doane.
So stand up proud and say it loud.
With Massey Ferguson.
Yeah!
There's media all around us. Media big and small.
There are media that are hard to kill, like in that movie by Seagal.
There's so much media everywhere, it's hard to find relief.
There's media in the food we eat and in the air we breathe.
I don't know what you're saying, but I know this much is true.
Our name is On the Media,
and we're the show for you.
On the Media.
Tune it in and turn it on.
On the Media.
We've got the Punditron.
On the Media.
We're your media watchdog.
On the Media.
At onthemedia.org.
Media,
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 media
deserves a second look.
Media,
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 media.
That's why you've got Bob and Brooke.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Kira Deppenbrock, David Sirchuk, Kathleen Horan, and the Keefe brothers, John and Dylan. Amy Pearl oversees our website.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large and composer of our corporate theme, arranged by John Dryden, not to be confused with our real theme, written by bassist composer Ben Allison. Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Hello to KVCR San Bernardino, which just picked up our show. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We're the show for you.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers' Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.